Hello and welcome to Need to Know, your weekly investment podcast brought to you by the experts at Coutts. I'm Sarah Muir and I'm joined as always by Coutts CIO Alan Higgins. Each week on the podcast, we look at the three things investors need to know for the week ahead. But before we get to that, Alan, I just wanted to find out, did you see, I think there was something in the FT this week about the fact that there's a big biography coming out about Elon Musk, friend of the podcast.
Yeah, I look forward to that. Yes, we enjoy talking about him. You know, quite an incredible career and a very unusual character. But we'll read it first, right?
Yeah. We don't make recommendations without reading first. And on the subject of Mr. Musk, I noticed, I think it was JP Morgan came out with a very sort of bullish prediction for Tesla's valuation, assuming that the launch of their AI supercomputer, we're back on that AI subject again. I think it's called Dojo, which is going to be part of their sort of self-driving cars. They reckon that's going to add $480 billion to the valuation of the company. Seems incredible.
I will try and pick up that piece of research. The share price was up 10% yesterday on this news. It would be called Dojo, wouldn't it?
It would, of course.
We'll come back. I'll read the research, whether it's JP Morgan or another bank. I'll read the research. But it sounds like a big compliance warning from you at the end.
Definitely. We are most definitely not recommending that you invest in Tesla or recommending that you don't. Neither. Either or. We're on the fence. It's a bit of a quiet week this week. We've both been sort of going through the various sort of financial press, and there's not an awful lot happening, a few bits and pieces. So what are the three things we need to know this week?
Yeah, so, you know, I read the Economist cover to cover, looking for something there. That's usually a good source, nothing there. But what I thought about, kind of got inspiration from looking at, when we talked about Michael Burry from The Big Short.
Oh, yes, The Big Short.
Who's the actor?
Christian Bale.
Christian Bale, thank you for
this. Yes.
Christian Bale, I should know, he's Welsh, I believe. So Christian Bale, so a reminder, he's bought a lot of put options looking for a big correction, dare I say, crash in the stock market. So it made me think, well, let's look at crashes.
Yeah.
So obviously, he's famous for 08-09. And any messages for today? And I'll start with the four big ones that I've experienced and right at the beginning, 1987.
Okay.
Cover that.
Yep.
Secondly, inflation, central banks. We've got all that going on. So the data. So we'll wrap it in the data, and then maybe separately, because a little bit disturbing. Oil's really moving higher here, and that's really going to be an issue. So cover oil as well, just very briefly.
Okay. Well, let's kick off as we usually do then with the data. We've got a couple. Well, we had a piece out on Tuesday, the day of recording. UK employment. We've got a couple of other bits and pieces happening this week, and we've got a big central bank meeting this week as well, haven't we?
Yeah, so let's cover the UK first. So the UK key has been wages. They came in as expected, just as expected, and that seems to be enough to be a bit of a sigh of a relief. But quite interestingly, the overall employment picture is starting to deteriorate. The unemployment rate has now risen a full 1%. From its lows, and therefore higher interest rates are starting to make an impact on the UK economy, and we expect that to continue. We've mentioned before the difference in the United States, especially the mortgage market in the United States compared to the mortgage market here. Yeah, so that makes sense. And wages probably a bit of a lagging indicator, and it's rare that we on this podcast side with the Bank of England, but we probably do, in the sense that, you know, good indications for inflation to fall in the future.
Yeah, certainly Andrew Bailey was sort of striking a slightly more dovish note, wasn't he, sort of recently, where he was sort of indicating that possibly perhaps we might we have a pause, or might we have a rate rise in September and then potentially a pause in November?
Yeah, that's what they seem to indicate. And the chief economist, Hugh Pill's, talking about Table Mountain.
Yes.
Yeah, I've never been there.
Have you been there? No, I haven't, no.
No, it's South Africa, but I know what they're talking about. Basically, to be fair, not just the UK, but the US, the language is moving towards, instead of focusing on rate hikes or rate cuts, keeping rates at this level for quite a long time.
Yeah.
Seems to be
what do we mean by quite a long time? Define quite a long time.
I can't do that. But okay.
We need to ask Mr. Pillon.
Yeah. So to answer, the US market and the UK market is pricing in rate cuts, essentially.
Yes.
small rate cuts at least, and basically pushing against that and saying, look, we're going to hold rates here for some time. We shall see. A couple of years is the answer. But it's not just the UK. We've got US CPI.
Yes, out on Thursday, I believe. Is that right?
Yeah. And the key to look at there is, I think we mentioned last time we covered inflation, it's all now at the month-on-month change. And it can't do much about oil, of course. That's going to impact the headline. But the core is very important. The market will be looking at core inflation. 0.2 is what expected. And if you think of 0.2, multiply by 12, that's 2.4. That's kind of good news.
Yeah.
A little bit dangerous, obviously, extrapolating just one monthly number. But we've had good monthly numbers now for a bit in the States. So let's look at that. And the central bank that's behind the curve, you know what I'm talking about, because I've always had to know them.
Yes, exactly. Yeah, they were the ECB. Apparently they're on a knife edge this week as to whether or not they hike this week. That's what I was reading.
Correct. I think that's right. It is a close call. I think big picture, you've got to say the rate structure in the Eurozone is much lower than the UK and the US.
Yeah.
And US has a pretty good inflation profile. The UK less so. So I just think common sense. I wonder whether they've done enough in terms of the Eurozone yet to raise rates.
Mm.
And I accept the German economy is weak.
Yeah.
The rest of the Eurozone is performing quite well, actually.
Yeah, I was going to say that's the challenge, isn't it? Because Germany is the engine that drives the Eurozone. They're obviously impacted by what's been happening in China. And I think I did read that there are expectations that the German economy could actually shrink.
Yeah, those are central expectations. That would be nothing new, actually. I know it sounds dramatic. The strength in the global economy is all about services. Anyone who's traveled, restaurants, hotels, etc., you know, post-COVID, people, you know, want to get their mojo back. And that's not Germany's strength. Of course, they do have a service sector. Germany's strength is industrial, exporting to China, etc. So, yeah, they are suffering. And, of course, the energy price is not at crisis levels as it was before, but it's still hurting.
Yeah. Okay. Well, so that's the data. We've got UK wages. We had UK sort of jobs data out on Tuesday. Wage growth was in line with expectations. Unemployment has gone up slightly. So, you know, as I say, bad news is good news at the moment. It looks perhaps like we'll get a rate hike from the Bank of England in September, potentially a pause in November. We've got US CPI. And as Alan points out, the number we're going to be looking at is that month-on-month figure. Expectations are that it will have gone up month-on-month by 0.2%. And it's the core figure that's the really important one. And we'll come to, we're going to talk about oil prices in a minute. And then obviously we've got the ECB. They've got a meeting this week. It's a critical decision whether they decide to hike rates or not. Some arguments are that it could be the last time they'll have an opportunity to hike, because we're starting to see a little bit of there's concerns about possibly stagflation in the Eurozone, certainly Germany, some predictions that their economy may shrink. And I've seen a few pieces in the press recently about the German economy as well, about, I know there was a piece in The Economist, and actually I've written a piece about the German economy, but that was quite a long time ago, but it's probably worth rereading. Google Sarah Muir Spectator, and you might find it. About the state of the German economy. I'll just give myself a little bit of a plug then.
I will read that, Sarah. I will read that with interest.
Yeah, I wrote it based on my experience of kind of working with a lot of German small and medium size enterprises and the challenges that the German psyche was suffering, because it was the time when there was a buildup of, you had the sort of disaster of the Berlin airport and all the sort of the overrun and the over budget, and you had the Hamburg Opera, not the Hamburg Opera House, I think it was the Hamburg Philharmonic, the Hamburg Concert Hall. And there are a number of things that were kind of knocking the German confidence. Anyway, let's move on. Enough of me blowing my own trumpet. Oil prices. Now, before we get to discussions about what's happened with oil prices, I just have one challenge for you. You were talking before about core inflation and how that's really, really important. But when we look at core inflation, we've stripped out energy prices, but surely the price of oil going up or down is really important for the man on the street, because it's how much it costs to fill your car, how much it costs to heat your home. How can we strip oil out of inflation and say it's not a core part of inflation?
Well, it's not core, but I think the answer is in the way you phrased the question. You said the man in the street suffers. The suffering that goes with higher oil prices, which is both companies and the consumer, and therefore it's effectively a tax on basically oil importers. And who receives the tax? Saudi Arabia, Norway, and Russia. So therefore, in my experience, notwithstanding, you know, there's it looks quite technical to me. So what's going on? So obviously, cut in supply, fine.
Mm.
Russia and Saudi Arabia teaming up, so-called OPEC plus. Two, the strategic reserves at the US are at low levels. They haven't been replenished. And there's a bit of speculation they're going to be forced in, if you like, to replenish. And they can't really supply the market. So a bit of a surprise, because we just mentioned the German economy, changing recession. We know China is weak. We're not particularly strong elsewhere. Okay, the US economy is performing okay. But in my experience, these don't last. In my experience, it's all about demand. And I would be very cautious about oil at these types of levels in terms of the taxation effect on the economy. As for inflation, it's fair, Sarah. The danger is if oil continues to rise, say, to $100 and stays there, then, yeah, you know, you and I work for EasyJet. We're going to have to raise our prices, et cetera, to use one simple example. So there is a bit of a danger. But, it, you know, in my experience, it's another negative for the global economy rather than an inflationary impulse.
OK, so why is it so difficult to predict what will happen to oil prices? Because it is notoriously difficult to predict. Is that fair to say?
It is. There's a couple of hedge funds out there that do it reasonably well. And but even they have huge volatility of returns of the order of up 50-60 to down 50-60%.
Wow.
Because they get caught out. It's just really, really tricky because of this double impact of, in the short run, supply can be so important.
Yeah. And the supply is controlled, isn't it, by OPEC Plus?
Not completely controlled. It's not like the 1970s, but somewhat controlled, I think, is the way to look at it. But then you have the impact on the global economy, and then you have, in the United States, the ability to start producing oil in quite an entrepreneurial way, so-called shale, of course, oil and gas, and can come fairly quickly. So very hard to predict. I wouldn't want to go there. It's kind of just what served me well in my career is to associate is to look at lower oil prices, to ignore the inflation impact and look at that as a boon for the global economy, and in contrast, higher oil prices, look at that as a tax on the global economy.
Okay, and I suppose we've got prices going up at the moment, and I know there's always an argument, because obviously the US economy is the world's biggest economy, that it's very important there, because you've got certain times of the year which are sort of dubbed the driving season. And we've finished with the driving season in America now, and I guess it will pick up again around Thanksgiving. Does that mean that rising oil prices at the moment will actually have less of an impact on, say, the US economy than they might have done had they happened earlier in the year?
Yeah, I think that's fair. I think that's at the margin. That's the consumer spending a bit more, but it's still very, very important for the industrial sector. And it's an obvious headwind for the airline sector, which has been booming, because everything we said earlier about this being a service sector economy right now. So, at the margin for the US, it's a bit less important. I think that's fair.
Okay. So just then, in a nutshell, what is driving higher prices at the moment? Is it just demand, because we're perhaps seeing a more resilient US economy?
So look, these are all theories. We don't really know. So it could be that Alan Higgins and team are completely wrong and the global economy is really strong. That could be theory one. Theory two is it's all to do with short-term supply squeeze from Saudi and Russia, and the fact that US reserves are at relatively low levels.
Yeah.
I'm comfortable with theory two. If the global economy is on fire over the next 6 months, I'll hold my hand up and say I was wrong again.
Okay. All right then. So just in summary then, we are seeing oil prices going up. You know, why? Well, the theory that sort of Alan Higgins and team subscribe to is that it's about a short-term supply squeeze. And obviously the US, their reserves are getting a little bit low. And that's why we're seeing a little bit of squeeze in the price. But as Alan said, it's notoriously difficult commodity to predict the price and to work out when it's going to go up and when it's going to go down. Even sort of experienced hedge funds, and that's their day job, find it. It's a very volatile commodity to be dealing in. Okay, on the subject of volatility, let's move on to your third point, which is all about crashes. And obviously, we talked about Michael Burry, and he's potentially has identified there may be a big market crash because he's taken out these big shorts. And you wanted to sort of take us back to the first crash of your career, not one that you were responsible for, I'd like to emphasize, but it was a biggie, wasn't it? And I guess it's sort of reflecting on whether anything we're seeing now kind of mirrors what we saw in 87. You know, could we be on the verge of another big crash?
Right. Yeah, I think it's an interesting question. And yes, I will go back to 1987, just to be fair to Michael Burry, just in case he listens in, because I know he's obsessive, is that he may be playing for a 10 to 15% correction. Mm. He could make some decent money. And of course, we see those all the time, nearly every year, at least once. And we're not talking about that. So what we're talking about is, I've set a figure of 35%, because we see quite a lot of minus 20% corrections as well. They're rarer also. But minus 35%, I've only seen four. And we'll start with 1987. And we're going to look back at all these crashes when news is quiet to see, well, are there any messages? And also a book review. Let's start.
Excellent.
With
another book recommendation. Good.
So A Man for All Markets, Beating the Odds from Las Vegas to Wall Street, Edward Thorpe. Fascinating. So those who may have seen the film or read the book Beat the Dealer, he was a blackjack card counter amongst other escapades. Really interesting. And then moved into Wall Street. And he has a great story about the 1987 crash, which I will come to. But you know, the interesting thing about the 1987 crash, Sarah, no one really, well, this, as I've said before, there's theories for everything, but the theories for the 1987 crash are especially woolly. When we had 08, 09 and the tech crash of 2003, it seems to be clearer. 87 to this day, people still write papers trying to explain it.
Okay. Well, I'm hoping you're going to be able to answer my question, because I remember I had nothing to do with working in sort of finance or in sort of investments in 1987. I was a mere stripling in 1987, but I do remember the crash because it was such a huge event. Of course, it happened around about the time that we had the great storm in the UK that poor old Michael Fish will forever be remembered for as not correctly forecasting, but we'll park that one. But okay, so this is a huge crash. What are some of the theories then as to why we saw? And well, okay, what was the size of the crash? How big are we talking here? And what are some of the theories as to what caused it?
Yeah, so let's go through. Focus more on the US, but other markets were broadly similar. So about a minus 35% event. But what was key? It was minus 22% in one day. So-called Black Monday, that we haven't seen before, minus 22% in one day. Really quite extraordinary. So this is the background. And firstly, there was a surge in equities beforehand. So over the previous 2.5 years, markets were up. This is the US market. And I apologize, but UK honestly is about the same. The US market was up 120%.
Okay.
So that's common, a surge. I'm pleased to say, bring it back to today, we don't have a surge, not much of a surge, which is similar today, a real bad bond bear market.
Yeah.
So 10-year yields in the US started the year at 7, and just before the crash got to 10.25%.
So this is in 1987.
So imagine that. All you need to do is buy 10-year treasuries in September 1987, and you earn 10% compound.
Sounds good.
Basically no risk, because it's US Treasury. Hold it to maturity, 10% compound. So really extraordinary. So theory number one, is that simply that ratio, that the relationship between bonds and equities became way too stretched.
Okay.
I like that theory. The PE ratio at the time, so price earnings ratio, I know we've got a lot of experienced listeners, but for those who are less so, that's kind of a way of valuing equities, one of the simpler ways, which is basically the multiple of earnings, the multiple of profits.
Yeah.
We got to 22 times earnings.
Okay. Which is not unheard of at the moment. That's not unheard of at the moment, is it?
No, so we're 20 times earnings as we speak here in the US. So price earnings ratios are relatively similar, 22 times earnings. But I think this is the key, that 22 times earnings in 1987 had to compete with 10 and a quarter.
Yes.
10 and a quarter bond yields, which, by the way, if you bought an IBM bond, you could get 11 and a half.
Goodness.
So you could get 11.5% because corporate bonds trade cheaper than bonds. So
essentially, there was no logic at all in investing in equities, because why would you? You're just going to put everything into corporate bonds.
That's theory one. Theory two, which is set out in the book, is that there was a new product introduced called portfolio insurance, where insurance companies basically said, we'll insure your portfolio, because what we'll do, as soon as the market starts to fall, we'll sell some for you. Momentum. Okay. Current today, it's called momentum. Mm-hmm. And so on that minus 22% day, I think this surely happened. You imagine you and I are in the business of doing insurance. We see the market down 3, 4, 5. And we think, oh, my God, we have to give some insurance to, I don't know, the pension fund of IBM, whatever it may be. We better sell some straight away. Sell some. And then another insurance company says, oh, my God, we've got to give some insurance to the pension fund of California. We better sell some straight away. So that it may. And the way they sold was using the futures market, which is a derivative.
Yeah.
It's a way, an easy way of shorting the market. And why does that have relevance? Because in this book, what happened? You had an incredible divergence between the future and where general stocks are trading in cash. The numbers are like this. Firstly, it's intriguing. Look how low the S&P 500 index was. Today it's 4,500. This is really about stocks for the long run.
Yeah.
The S&P 500 was at 220.
Okay.
Only. The future was at 185.
Okay.
Okay. So literally, but people were too scared to do it. So what Ed Thorpe did was a genius, is buy futures at 185 and sell short individual stocks at 220, a basket of stocks. We covered shorting, didn't we, Sarah?
We did, yes.
So it was trickier then. There was a so-called uptick rule, a very strange rule where you could only short a stock when it's moved up just slightly.
Okay.
And also, as we mentioned before,
you couldn't short it on the way down.
You can't short it, that's right. You have to borrow the stock. But he managed to do it and made a huge profit during that. And it's quite intriguing, behavioral, because he recalls a conversation with his head dealer, and his head dealer refused to do it. His head dealer was so traumatized by the minus 22% day, he refused to do it. Ed literally had to force him, but basically almost said, you're going to lose your job over this unless you do this trade. And eventually he did do it. So those are the theories. Absolutely intriguing. Now, however, stocks are for the long run and they're a growth asset.
Yeah.
I
need to jump in and ask you a question. So how quickly did markets recover from that crash, that 35% crash?
You've actually asked me a question I don't exactly know. I've got the piece of data I've got in front of me, because I've got my Bloomberg screen, but it's hard going back that far in the sense of programming, but a bit of program as you speak. Well, I'll say what I do know. What I do know is that for 1987 as a whole, stocks were unchanged. So you had
the end of the year
boom.
Unchanged.
Yeah. Okay. We had a boom up 40%, bust minus 35%.
Okay.
And ended up unchanged on the year. But what I can tell you is over 5 years, because I looked over 5 years, we're in the business of wealth management, as are others. So this is not about you, this is about everyone. Over 5 years, basically, if you bought just before the crash, you would have been da down 35%, disaster.
Yeah.
But amazingly, over 5 years, you'd made 60%. So you made that 35% back, which, by the way, mathematicians on here, I know it's more than 35% because of the nature of compounding. But basically, over 5 years, and this shows why we on this podcast we say stocks are the best asset in the long run for savings because they're a growth asset. You made 10% compound,
Okay.
right? But you know, why don't you say something interesting? You can tell this is spontaneous while I
Okay. Yeah, whilst you're doing that.
pull up the
Okay.
S&P
Well,
500.
I have another question for you because we're talking about crashes, and obviously we're kind of reflecting a little bit on Michael Burry's decision to, well, we don't know quite what his expectations are, but we're sort of extrapolating probably maybe a dip in markets of could be as little as 10%. But is there any correlation between a really big surge with a really big crash? Is it the bigger the surge, the bigger the fall afterwards? Or is there any kind of relationship between those two things?
There is, and we'll especially see this when we cover the tech crash. But it's the nature of human nature. It's human nature. Tulip bubble,
Yeah.
huge bubble crash. Some elements of crypto that we've talked about. So yes, that's true. But let me answer your question because I've pulled it up here. So September 87, virtually the peak. October 87, the big crash. You were back, you bought at the peak, you were back to break even about June 89. So it took you 2 years, and then markets started to surge again.
Okay, so two uncomfortable years, and then you started to feel a little bit more comfortable with your decision.
Yeah, well, obviously no one likes buying at the peak. Hopefully
No.
people don't, but for those who bought after the crash, obviously phenomenal investment. But the point being that over 5 years, go back to that number, 5 years later, you bought at the peak. There was no mobile phones in those days. So you could, let's just say you were very lucky. You couldn't check your statement and
Yeah.
ignore the newspapers. 5 years later, you woke up. Oh, good news. I made 60% on my stocks without knowing. I've actually had that happen to me in my professional life. Just so I had a client come in. I'll say he was a rock star, and it was 15-16 when markets were correcting. That was about a minus 20% correction, and he was a bit concerned. And I showed him, I said, well, this is nothing new. Have a look at 0809. And he looked at 0809, which we're going to cover, which was a minus 50% event. And he said, oh, good job, I was touring so much, and I didn't notice that. Otherwise, I might have panicked. And I thought that was a funny story, but. So we'll end there. So that's the first one, 1987. Ed
Okay.
Thorpe, a man for all markets, not just about markets. I mean,
Okay.
he even invented a machine that he thought could count at roulette, you know, as kind of a mini
Okay.
wearable computer. Fascinating individual, super bright, obviously, and good hedge fund. He also spotted Madoff earlier, relatively early.
Oh, good for him. Well, yeah, nobody listened to him, unfortunately. I guess then, just to bring this back to sort of 2023, are we saying there are any parallels that we can draw between 87 and 23? I mean, obviously, it's fair to say we've got a bond bear market, I think, haven't we? And we've got, earnings at fairly high ratios, but are we sort of saying it's different because we haven't had that big surge prior?
Yeah, it's not as extreme. So if you like, you can see where Michael Burry's coming from. A big rise in bond yields, making bonds more attractive. So the numbers are 4.5 versus 10.25. That's such a big difference, though. And S&P 500 at 20 times earnings in pretty much both cases. So you can see reasons why a minus 10% might happen on that. I struggle, frankly, to see that as a minus 35% event. But look, Michael Burry was the genius who made money in 0809. So, yeah, if you're listening, do feel free to come on or make a comment and tell us what you're really looking for. But on that, actually, we've had a fair few comments come to me. We should make it easier for people to get in touch with us, shouldn't we?
Yeah, absolutely. If you've got any comments, positive feedback, we always love a bit of positive feedback. Or if you've got anything that you would like Alan to talk about, or you'd like me to ask him and put him on the spot, do contact, you can contact myself. I'm Sarah with an H. Muir, that's M-U-I-R, at coots.com. We welcome all your nice comments, please. Nothing too rude. And yeah, if you've got thoughts or anything you'd like us to talk about, anything you'd like us to cover, then email me and we can pick that up. It'd be fun to start getting a little bit of a few requests in. Okay, well, thank you very much, Alan. A reminder that the views expressed in this podcast are not intended to constitute investment advice, are accurate at the time of recording, and are subject to change. Thank you very much, Alan, for joining me today. Don't forget to check out either the podcast page on coots.com, or hopefully now you're already subscribing to Need to Know via Apple, Spotify, or wherever you access your podcasts. We'll be back next week with more Need to Know. Until then, bye for now.